This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Sex Scandal: The Drive to Abolish Male and Female by Ashley McGuire. This book is read by Aaron Bennett. All charts, diagrams, and photographs that appear in the print edition of this book can be found in the bonus PDF file that accompanies your audiobook CD or download. For Brian. Introduction. Sex has become scandalous. I don't mean the sex you're thinking of, the thing that men needle each other about in the locker room, that women talk about in hushed tones over glasses of wine, that men and women have been fighting over and laughing about since the dawn of humanity. That kind of sex has always been a little bit scandalous, and it still is, even in today's anything-goes world. I'm talking about sex as it demarcates male and female, the basic biological and physiological differences that tell us with scientific certainty whether a human being is a man or woman, and all that that entails. That right there has become a matter of national scandal. Somehow, it has become a violation of the accepted code of conduct to suggest that men and women are different and to act accordingly. The very word sex in the sense of basic biological difference is no longer used in everyday life. It's been replaced by gender, which itself has been rendered practically meaningless. The scientific and medical communities still have clear definitions of sex and gender. Society denies them almost entirely. Living in denial. Indeed, we live in a world of sexual denial. We are increasingly trying to treat men and women as if they were exactly the same. And then we're surprised by the growing sexual confusion. Take romance, for example. Women lament its demise, and men hardly know how to be affectionate toward a woman, or even treat her with respect, without finding themselves in danger of sexism or chauvinism. Men can't win. If they don't hold a door, pull out a chair, or pay for dinner, they're jerks. If they do, they're patronizing. Women are just as confused. They say they want real romance, but they're content to move in with a guy, do his laundry, and cook his meals for little more in return than the chance of Valentine's Day tickets to see 50 Shades of Grey. You may have noticed the whitewashing of sexual difference in one small way or another. But if you look closely, you will see strands of sex denial everywhere. Maybe a toy or activity disappeared from your child's school for gender equity reasons. Maybe your high school son was elected to homecoming court only to be crowned as a unisex royal because calling him homecoming king would be offensive. Maybe a battle is brewing in your school district about whether high school boys should be allowed access to the girls' locker room. Maybe you're a college student who is majoring in gender studies and just got invited by the cute guy who lives on your floor and showers in your bathroom to a secretary's and boss's party at the frat down the street. Or maybe you've graduated and are on the dating scene, or rather, wishing you knew where exactly that scene is and why casual sex seems to be the price of admission to any meaningful contact with the opposite sex. Or maybe you're with your girlfriends at a nail salon, reading magazines and wondering how it came to be that a man who won a gold medal at the Olympics as a decathlete is complaining that choosing clothes is the hardest part about being a woman, or why everyone suddenly seems to agree that women should be drafted into the military and sent into combat. Maybe you are a professional who was recently required to undergo workplace training where you were taught that gender is fluid and a meaningless label. You had to spend 5 hours discussing male and female characteristics that make up the supposedly socially constructed gender binary, which you can't help thinking has a lot to do with biology. Or maybe you are an employer terrified by the prospect of being slapped with a $200,000 fine if you refer to an employee by the wrong pronoun. In some cases, it seems, sexual difference still does matter. Feeling confused? I don't blame you. It seems like you woke up one day and suddenly it was normal for kindergartens to ban Legos as sexist, for high school boys to shower in the girls' locker room, and for America to send the mothers of toddlers to defend us from our enemies. But the reality is that the denial of sexual differences has been unfolding before us for decades. The Battle of the Sexes. On September 20, 1973, tens of thousands of people crammed into the Houston Astrodome in the scorching afternoon heat. About 90 million more sat in front of their televisions in eager anticipation. Everyone was dying to watch what had been dubbed the Battle of the Sexes. Bobby Riggs, one of the greatest tennis stars in history, had challenged female tennis star Billie Jean King to a match for show. Riggs, who made no effort to hide his sexist disdain for women in sports, had been taunting King, who had collected 10 singles titles before turning 30, for some time. Riggs was constantly provoking King and other rising female tennis stars with misogynistic jeers like, "The best way to handle women is to keep them pregnant and barefoot," or, "Women belong in the bedroom and kitchen in that order," and, "Women play about 25% as good as men, so they should get about 25% of the money men get." One woman had already taken Riggs's bait. Margaret Cook, then the highest-ranked woman in tennis, agreed to play him for a cash prize of $10,000. In what became known as the Mother's Day Massacre, Riggs walloped her 6-2, 6-1. Making things worse, Cook told reporters afterward that she was outmatched. "We girls don't play like that," she said. But Riggs wasn't satisfied. He wanted to beat Billie Jean King, whom he called a women's liber leader. He challenged her repeatedly, saying, "I'll play her on clay, grass, wood, cement, marble, or roller skates. We got to keep this sex thing going. I'm a woman specialist now." To everyone's shock, King finally agreed to an exhibition match with a $100,000 purse. Before a combined live and TV audience of nearly 100 million, at the time the biggest audience for any tennis match in history, King entered the arena dressed like Cleopatra and carried by men in togas, while Riggs was wheeled in by half-naked women labeled Bobby's Bosom Buddies. King gifted Riggs with a baby pig, and Riggs gave King a giant sugar daddy lollipop, which he described as "the largest sucker I could find for the biggest sucker I know." But the Battle of the Sexes was not a circus spectacle. Despite the gimmicks, it was truly emblematic of women's struggle to lay claim to a broader role in society and to establish whether new opportunities for them on paper meant anything in reality. In what many have called a turning point for women, Billie Jean King beat Bobby Riggs fair and square in all three sets. The History Channel later reported that the Battle of the Sexes turned King into arguably the first superstar female athlete in the United States. King went on to form a public truce with Riggs, and the two became lifelong friends. King had an illustrious career, at the end of which she founded the Women's Sports Foundation, which still advocates for girls and women in sports today. King later said of the Battle of the Sexes, "I thought it would set us back 50 years if I didn't win that match. It would ruin the women's tour and affect all women's self-esteem." Yet 50 years later, it appears as though things are backsliding. Billie Jean King and other female champions staked out a space for women's sports, which earned the respect of the American people and the legal backing of Congress. They fought for that space on the grounds of their sex. But what happens to women's sports in a world where the very reality of sexual difference is in dispute? Making sport of sex. In 2013, mixed martial artist Fallon Fox, who had been a woman to her training partners and opponents for the last 5 years and had been tearing through her female opponents, came out as having been born in a male body. After much deliberation, the UFC allowed the biological male to continue fighting against women. The following year, Fox sent a female opponent, Tamika Brents, to the hospital after just 2 minutes of fighting. Brents suffered a broken skull and a concussion and needed 7 surgical staples. She said of the match, "I've never felt so overpowered ever in my life. I've fought a lot of women and never felt the strength I felt in a fight as I did that night." Even after being hospitalized, Brents knew she had to toe the PC line. "I can't answer whether it's because she was born a man or not, because I'm not a doctor. I can only say, I've never felt so overpowered ever in my life, and I am an abnormally strong female in my own right." That a female athlete landed in the hospital because of her opponent's patently obvious biological advantage did not matter. Hinting at that reality was the scandal. "MMA fighter Fallon Fox is a woman. Get over it," barked the title of a Paris Lee's article on Vice. "People get hurt. All the time. It's their job. I appreciate your gut reaction may be one of sympathy toward Fallon's vanquished opponent, Tamika Brents, but a China doll she isn't. She's a successful MMA fighter who could have opted out of the fight beforehand if she truly believed Fallon had an unfair advantage over her. There's no cause for concern because biological sex isn't black and white. Except that it is. As this book will detail, science offers a pretty plain definition of what sex is. But increasingly, top decision makers, from the bureaucrats at the Department of Education to the members of the International Olympic Committee, IOC, have decided that science no longer applies. The 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro marked the first time that athletes could compete against members of the sex with which they self-identify, not the sex with which they are categorized by science. And yes, that means men can compete in women's events. Dare to raise a hand in protest, even on the grounds of basic fairness, and you are the scandal. You're in the army now. Somewhere along the line, the battle of the sexes turned into the scandal of the sexes. Speaking of battle, it has even become a sign that you're insufficiently committed to equality if you argue against literally sending women into battle, even if it's against their will. Young women now face the very real prospect of being forced to register for selective service. Advocates for drafting women will brush off the significance of that fact. We aren't going to have another draft. Then why is it so important that women be forced to sign up? The end goal of an elite segment of our society is the eradication of any distinction between the sexes. Equal treatment sounds nice, but as is often pointed out in the context of economics, equal treatment does not necessarily yield equal outcomes. You give a young man and a young woman a rifle and a 100-pound pack and the exact same training and send them into war, and they will most certainly face unequal odds of surviving unscathed. You fill a frat house with men and women and booze and turn off the lights, and there will be unequal outcomes. A man and a woman have sexual intercourse, and 9 months later they can end up in very unequal situations. The willful blindness to basic biological difference under the mantra of equality ultimately disempowers women. It forces them to compete on male terms and punishes them when they fail. It creates a societal preference for the masculine, the physically stronger, and the more aggressive, putting women at a disadvantage. It gives us a world where movies about torture sex are considered romantic, but Shakespeare is banned from college classrooms because his maleness is a threat. A world where ROTC cadets are forced to wear high heels to show solidarity with rape victims, but female midshipmen at the Naval Academy aren't allowed to wear skirts to graduation. A world where a woman with a sugar daddy isn't just a prop in a Bobby Riggs tennis spectacle, but a woman just using her sex appeal as a perfectly valid means to pay for her Ivy League education. A world where the Midwife Alliance of North America feels pressured to call pregnant women birthing individuals, lest someone be offended by the notion that it is women, and only women, who bear children. Sex needn't be a scandal. It should be a source of potential and the starting point for true equality. The things that make us different can't be changed, but understanding them can help us to build a better and more just society that gives both men and women the chance to live freely and authentically. I mean it entirely differently when I echo Bobby Riggs in saying, "We got to keep this sex thing going." But first, we have to remind ourselves what sex actually means. Chapter 1. The kids are not all right. Nature wants children to be children before being men. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Emile. "Don't let the doctor do this to your newborn," reads a scary headline that pops into my Facebook newsfeed. With a baby due in mere weeks, I take the bait and click. Imagine you are in recovery from labor, lying in bed, holding your infant. In your arms, you cradle a stunningly beautiful, perfect little being. Completely innocent and totally vulnerable, your baby is entirely dependent on you to make all the choices that will define their life for many years to come. They are wholly unaware, at least for now, that you would do anything and everything in your power to protect them from harm and keep them safe. You are calm, at peace. Sounds nice. The article goes on to describe a scene in which an ominous obstetrician walks in with a suspicious grin and gloved hands reaching for your baby insistently. "It's time for your child's treatment," he says menacingly. The article goes on. Obstetricians, doctors, and midwives commit this procedure on infants every single day, in every single country. In reality, this treatment is performed almost universally without even asking for the parent's consent, making this practice all the more insidious. "Well, what the heck is it?" I wonder frantically. Finally, I reach the answer. It's called infant gender assignment. When the doctor holds your child up to the harsh light of the delivery room, looks between its legs, and declares his opinion, it's a boy or a girl, based on nothing more than a cursory assessment of your offspring's genitals. Embarrassed, I realize that I've been punked. What I expected to be a serious, scientific article about a medical procedure performed on newborn babies in hospitals against the wishes of mothers like myself was actually just another gender theory diatribe in Slate. I never knew a newborn's genitals could be so scandalous. And yet they are. There are people in America who consider it criminal and abusive to identify children by their biological sex. And they are coming for yours. Princesses need not apply. Just about every mom will readily admit that Target is one of the best places to shop for kids' stuff. The clothes are cheap and adorable. Whether it's a pair of pink jellies for a little girl or baseball jammies for a baby boy, and so is just about everything they sell. The store is well organized, making it very easy for frazzled parents to head directly for the sections they need. Clothes and shoes are well arranged and clearly labeled by age and sex, as are bedding, backpacks, undies, you name it. Or they were until the gender radicals got to them. In August of 2015, Target announced a new corporate policy. They would be moving away from gender-based signage. Apparently, it was hurting some people's feelings. As a post on Target's corporate website explained, the signs had led to certain customers feeling frustrated or limited by the way things are presented. Over the past year, guests have raised important questions about a handful of signs in our stores that offer product suggestions based on gender. One can hardly be blamed for wondering who these guests are. Certainly not frazzled parents just trying to do some shopping without getting swept up in a battle about gender dysphoria. Nope, not those guests. Because these mystery customers had enough spare time to pressure Target into making children the target of the latest trend in sex denial in America. Target agreed to eliminate all gender-based signage in its toy, home, and entertainment sections, and clarified that in the toy section, they would even cease using pink, blue, yellow, or green paper on the back walls of our shelves. Finally, No more offensive yellow walls, said no parent ever. Target left clothing alone for now, but kids' clothes are certainly up next. When I clicked on a recent Huffington Post article that came floating through my newsfeed, 13 empowering photos show there's no right way to be a boy. Part of the A Boy Can Too hashtag campaign, the first image that appeared was one of a young boy in a wide-brimmed hat and ruffled dress. He was dressed as Scarlett O'Hara. As Ruth Margolis wrote for The Week, liberal parents did some celebratory fist pumping when Target announced last week that it would bend to customer criticism and stop separating toys into boys and girls sections. It's heartening that Target is bringing its floor plans into the 21st century where, I hope, it's a given that some little girls play with cars and some boys like dressing up Elsa dolls. But if the retailer really wanted to advance equality of the sexes for kids, they'd tear down the gender divide in their children's clothing section. Margolis boycotts Target because they don't sell gender-fluid garb for tots. Plenty of moms share Margolis's frustration with the princess-heavy nature of the girls' clothing section. And yet my daughter's clothes come almost exclusively from Target, and I've never bought a thing with a princess on it. There are plenty of non-Disney options in the girls' clothing section at Target. But that doesn't stop Margolis from wondering if they assume that once the infant phase is over, we're all gagging to put our squishy, sexless toddler girls in insipid florals? Actually, yes. And hipster jeggings, boho eyelet tops, and rompers with Native American stitchwork. My daughter is dressed that way, and many of her Target-purchased clothes are in styles I would buy for myself. None of her clothes scream, "My life goal is to marry Prince Charming," but they're recognizably feminine. It's one thing to fret about the princess culture and the messages it sends to girls. It's entirely another to think clothing that reflects a girl or boy's sex is scandalous. And just what is gender-neutral or gender-fluid clothing? For girls, it's certainly less girly. Does a toddler boy seem less like a boy in single-color, frill-free t-shirts, which Margolis suggests as more ideal and practical for today's parents? No. Does a toddler girl seem less like a girl in that same outfit? You bet. In fact, what people call gender-neutral clothing is just clothing washed of feminine characteristics. Girlish traits are dropped in favor of a more boyish look. There have been some exceptions. One successful attempt at breaking free of gender stereotypes in kids' clothing without washing out femininity is Princess Awesome, a self-funded company started by two moms looking for girls' clothes that are more than just pink dresses adorned with princesses or flowers or ruffles. Their clothing line, which advertises itself as a different kind of girly, offers things like the She-Rex Dinosaurs Twirly Play Dress or the Super Secret Hidden Ninja Play Dress. But while Princess Awesome still allows girls to wear dresses, plenty of gender-neutral clothing companies for tots, such as those that are a part of the Clothes Without Limits campaign, drip with virtue signaling, using advertising lines like, "We create baby clothes that break down stereotypes," or "Our clothes flip the script on gender cliches," or "We believe that all kids should be hashtag free to wear pink, regardless of their gender." For parents perfectly comfortable dressing their boys and girls as girls and boys, it's all a bit exhausting. Anyway, Target sidestepped clothing for now to focus on more low-hanging fruit, toys. No doubt the suits in corporate felt pressure when one woman's tweet about her shopping experience at Target went viral. The tweet included a picture of a Target sign advertising building sets and underneath, girls' building sets. The sign is admittedly cringeworthy, but the woman was not a random Target shopper. Turns out the mom behind the viral photo is Abby Bechdel, an outspoken activist and writer who has been published in places like ExoJane and Time, and who describes herself on her Twitter page as, among other things, a sexual libertine and conversational terrorist. After her Target tweet went viral, She went on a media tour harping on Target for sorting things for kids by sex. Exactly the kind of nightmare scenario that makes head honchos freak out, even if 99% of their customers would still like to be able to find girls' bedding without having to dig through a pile of Thomas the Tank Engine comforters for gender equity reasons. One loud customer who takes to the media can drown out 1 million others who are too busy to politicize their everyday shopping. To be fair, there are concerns about gendered toys that are not radical or insane. For example, while mothers of all political stripes worry about what has become known as the princess culture, that concern doesn't mean hating everything related to princesses. It's a dislike for the gaudy and sparkly Disney retail world that presents the ideal woman as a damsel in distress with a 2-inch waist.
It's hard to tell how much of the princess culture is explained by girls' seemingly innate inclination toward all things princess and how much of it can be chalked up to Disney's marketing savvy.
As Peggy Orenstein reported for the New York Times, princess, as some Disney execs call it, is not only the fastest growing brand the company has ever created, they say it is on its way to becoming the largest girls' franchise on the planet. Indeed, the Disney princess world is a $5 billion industry, with what can seem like a monopoly on girl products. These days, keeping a 3-year-old girl away from Disney's princesses is a lot like trying to get through January without hearing about the Super Bowl, to use one journalist's comparison. Many parents worry that the princess culture heightens the pressures on today's girls to look and act a certain way, and cultivates a sense of entitlement that won't work out so well in adulthood. Newer Disney offerings like Frozen and Sophia the First seem designed to quell the growing anti-princess fervor among today's more feminist mothers. They're refashioning the princess as smart, practical, and independent. And a recently launched Disney campaign dubbed Dream Big Princess seeks to bring girl power to the masses. A blog post announcing the campaign said, "There's nothing in the world quite like a Disney princess. Whether it be Rapunzel's go-getter spirit, Mulan's die-hard ambition, or Ariel's thirst for a better life in a better world, women and children alike have been inspired and moved by countless tales of these classic female protagonists." Sure, it's a marketing pitch, but they have a point. A thoughtful review of pre-Frozen Disney heroines reveals they aren't merely damsels in distress. Belle walks around town with her nose in a book and sought something more than this provincial life. Ariel takes a major risk to explore a totally different world. Cinderella wins the heart of the prince because she isn't the fawning fool that he's used to. Captain Smith winds up relying on Pocahontas to save his life. To Disney's credit, while many of their princesses have unrealistic figures and expose too much skin, they're actually pretty courageous women who win their men primarily because of their virtues. They are kind when others are cruel. They are fearless when others are afraid. They are intelligent when others are not. Ultimately, they win happiness for themselves, often with a prince and kingdom thrown in. Perhaps the princess culture, flawed as it may be, is one way girls celebrate what makes them stand apart. An instinctive expression of their differentness from boys that begins when they start understanding sexual difference. And perhaps the princess culture's not-so-great aspects are a reflection of rampant commercialization and materialism more than anything else, a materialism that influences the clothing and toys geared toward boys as well. But some feminists were so upset about the princess culture that they decided to launch an ad called Potty-Mouthed Princesses. In the ad, girls dressed in princess outfits make fun of princess speak and yell a litany of profanities and tired feminist talking points at the camera. "I'm not some pretty expletive helpless princess in distress. I'm pretty expletive powerful and ready for success." So what is more offensive, a little girl saying expletive or the expletive unequal way society treats women? So listen up, grown-ups. Here's some words more expletive up than the word expletive: pay inequality. I'll stop there and spare you the remaining 2 minutes of 6-year-olds dropping F-bombs and yelling about rape. It's as appalling as it sounds, bordering on child abuse. At the end of the ad, just after a few boys dressed in princess outfits come out and yell too, women who are presumably the mothers of these underage political props appear and hawk t-shirts saying, "This is what a feminist looks like," sold by the ironically named company FCK Hate. The ad's potty-mouthed princesses made the rounds on the web, racking up lots of acclaim from radical feminists. Lane Moore, the sex and relationships editor for Cosmopolitan magazine, wrote that seeing girls dressed as princesses and cursing like sailors to spread the message of feminism is like a gift I didn't know to ask for. Jezebel called the girls awesome. The problem is that the little girls in the ad come off looking like caricatures of the lewdest teenage boy imaginable. They look angry and aggressive, more like drunk men than little girls. Is this really a pro-woman message? Why should the price of equality be that girls abandon their girliness? Sex denial in the classroom. Princesses aren't the only toys standing in the way of gender equity. In the mind of one kindergarten teacher, Legos propagate gender differences too, so she banned boys from playing with them. The idea, according to Seattle elementary school teacher Karen Keller, was that if boys couldn't play with Legos, girls would be more inclined to use them, instead of gravitating toward toys like dolls, as they typically did. I always tell the boys, "You're going to have a turn," and I'm like, "Yeah, when hell freezes over in my head," she told a local news outlet. "I just feel like we are still so far behind in promoting gender equity," she continued. Her decision drew national attention in the fall of 2015, at which point the school received a deluge of enraged phone calls from parents. The teacher's name disappeared from its website, and the school issued a statement saying that the Lego ban for boys was an isolated short-term practice that ended in October. All students in all classrooms have and will continue to have access to all instructional and non-instructional materials. As the Lego kerfuffle suggests, American schools are the latest battleground over whether students and parents are allowed to acknowledge even the most basic differences between the sexes. Children are now actively encouraged to explore their gender by schools that are actively encouraged to sow sexual confusion among children. A recent CNN story, for example, urges schools to foster a welcoming environment for gender nonconforming students and find ways to accommodate children who are opening up about gender identity as early as kindergarten. Suggestions include making sure boys and girls are never separated by sex and using gender-neutral greetings like "Good morning, class," instead of "Good morning, boys and girls." The article quotes one teacher as saying, "We need to be sure we don't create structures and artifices to reinforce binaries that limit and constrain the ways in which we behave and express ourselves." One Milwaukee elementary school recently held what it called Gender Bender Day, in which boys were encouraged to dress like girls and vice versa. After parents balked, the day was renamed Switch It Up Day, but the event went on. At some high schools, it's no longer permitted to refer to a homecoming king or queen. One must use the genderless royal instead. As a Wisconsin principal told the Today Show about his school's move to ban king and queen, the elected royal couple could even be off the binary spectrum. An elementary school in South Carolina was forced to cancel its annual father-daughter dance, also a successful fundraiser for the school's parent-teaching organization, over complaints that the dance was not inclusive of all genders. This despite the fact that, as the school district spokeswoman stated, it was never an event that was exclusive to only fathers and daughters. Mothers and anyone else who wanted to show up at the dance were certainly welcome to attend. But increasingly, the sexual confusion begins right in the classroom, with the rise of curricula that teach gender is a fluid social construct and sex is a meaningless label assigned at birth. In Virginia's Fairfax County, for instance, the school board issued a report in 2015 recommending that a new sex ed curriculum teach middle and high school age children that there is a broader, boundless, and fluid spectrum of sexuality that is developed throughout a lifetime. Despite being a liberal county, a bastion of Washington, D.C.'s wealthy elite, parents freaked. According to a Washington Post story about the school board meeting at which the proposal was discussed and voted upon, the 10-2 vote Thursday night came amid shouts of anger and howls of frustration from a raucous crowd that largely stood in opposition to the curriculum changes. In an indicator of what's yet to come, the board had initially proposed moving parts of the curriculum out of sex ed and into the health class. Parents can opt their children out of sex ed. Health class is mandatory. In a last-minute concession, the board relented on the class switch, and parents were assured that, for now, they can pull their kids out of classes that are teaching that gender is a meaningless and malleable construct. Fairfax County joins other schools around the country in enshrining sexual confusion into curricula designed for children. In Washington State, the confusion begins long before middle school. The state educational governing body lists, "Understand there are many ways to express gender as a core idea in the realm of sexual health for kindergartners." But schools shift away from using sex as the basis of children's identity has implications beyond playtime and sex ed. The end of women's sports? Bernice Sandler, dubbed the godmother of Title IX, called the legislation that she helped to draft the most important step for gender equality since the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote. Title IX is just 37 words buried in a major education bill passed in 1972, 37 words that changed everything when it came to women's sports, according to ESPNW, ESPN's online vertical for women. Those words run, "No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any educational program or activity receiving federal financial assistance." In an interview with ESPNW, Sandler admitted that girls' sports were not at the top of the priority list when the legislation was in the works. "The only thought I gave to sports when the bill was passed was, oh, maybe now when a school holds its field day, there will be more activities for the girls." But Title IX turned out to be a major boost for girls' sports. ESPN notes that female participation in high school sports soared 1,079% over the following four decades and rose at a similar rate among college students. Male participation at the high school level grew by 22% in the same time. Though plenty of change that arose during the sweeping social upheaval of the 70s was deeply divisive and remains so today, increasing opportunities for women to play sports offered some common ground. A new generation of girls grew up enjoying sports as a healthy outlet and a place to cultivate friendships and leadership skills. For some, talent and hard work led to great professional and financial opportunities. That generation, which I am part of, grew up knowing that women could succeed in sports without sacrificing what it meant to be a woman. Sports was not a man's domain, and being a female athlete didn't mean you were just like one of the guys. We grew up watching the likes of Florence Griffith Joyner, known affectionately to Americans as FloJo, an Olympic track and field athlete who is still considered the fastest woman of all time. She was known not just for the world records she still holds, but also for her feminine beauty and her dazzling nails. As the Los Angeles Times once described her in a story about the way she inspired an entire generation of high school girls to pursue their athletic passions, FloJo was the great track athlete, the lovely lady with the long fingernails and great clothes. Her husband, Al Joyner, also an Olympic gold medalist, said that what Florence always wanted was to see track prosper and to see more girls want to run. Title IX was an essential part of making that happen for hundreds of thousands of girls who have run track in high school and beyond. But for the first time in 40 years, the opportunities that Title IX created for female athletes are under threat. Women's sports face a major test in the fallout from sex denial, biological males on girls' sports teams. For decades, Title IX kicked in when a girl wanted to play a sport, but no girls' team was offered at her school. a school had to make an effort to offer equal athletic opportunities for boys and girls, and when it could not, it had to allow girls to play on the boys' team. But now, under the gender theory regime, Title IX is being co-opted to permit boys to play on girls' teams, too. The phenomenon went mostly unnoticed until 2011, when male high school senior Will Higgins competed in a girls' state swim meet in Massachusetts. He won the 50-yard freestyle race and broke the meet record, with a time that would not have even qualified him to compete in the same race in the boys' division. The lead paragraph of a Boston Globe article covering the controversy that ensued was Orwellian. The governing body that regulates high school athletics in Massachusetts is taking a closer look at the controversy surrounding mixed-gender swim teams and will soon address the issue of boys breaking girls' swimming records. That same fall, boys competed on 8 different high school girls' swim teams in Massachusetts, and several of the boys qualified to compete at the state level. The Globe summed up the situation. Athletic officials are limited in what they can do. In the eyes of the MIAA, Massachusetts Interscholastic Athletic Association, there's no stopping boys from competing on girls' swim teams because state law mandates equal access to sports for both genders. If a boy wants to swim and there is no boys' swimming program offered at his school, he is allowed to swim with the girls. The same issue came up for debate in Pennsylvania in 2013, prompted by a surge in boys playing on girls' sports teams. One survey conducted by the Pennsylvania Interscholastic Athletic Association, PIAA, found that approximately 30% of schools reported having boys on a girls' sports team. When worried parents of girls began to protest, the state dug in its heels, taking the position that gender equity in sports means blindness to sexual difference. Pennsylvania's then Attorney General said, "Athletic equity is required by the Pennsylvania Equal Rights Amendment, and the ERA will not allow a rule barring boys from participating or playing on girls' teams, just as the ERA will not allow a rule barring girls from participating or playing on boys' teams." Unsurprisingly, the pushback came from women. The Women's Sports Foundation, founded by none other than female tennis legend Billie Jean King of Battle of the Sexes fame, argued that a proper reading of Title IX protects the rights of women to have their own space for athletics, and that separating the sexes athletically gives girls and women a truly equal opportunity to succeed. Like the concerned parents of girls, the Women's Sports Foundation argued that allowing boys onto girls' sports teams could reverse the advances that female athletics has made and threatens girls' opportunities for scholarships. The foundation pointed out, "While courts have found girls to have the right to compete on boys' teams under Title IX, the courts have not granted boys the same access to girls' teams. This is to ensure that women are not deprived of athletic opportunities or scholarships." Despite great gains for women since the 1970s, the foundation's website notes, female high school athletes still have 1.3 million fewer athletic opportunities than men. Female college athletes have 63,000 fewer opportunities at NCAA schools and receive $183 million less in athletic scholarships at NCAA schools. Title IX remains very popular with the American public, boasting the support of 8 in 10 voters, spanning political and familial demographics. The American public, the foundation states, believes that sports participation is as important for our daughters as it is for our sons. Eventually, the PIAA took the issue to court, asking the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to reopen its 1973 decision ruling on Title IX as it applied to high school athletics. The PIAA made the same case as the Women's Sports Foundation, that the purpose of Title IX was not to mandate complete sex blindness when it came to sports, but rather to ensure that women have the same chance to compete athletically as men. Allowing boys onto girls' teams threatened that equality. The PIAA cited a mountain of data, such as the differences in height and weight between the average high school male and female, that have resulted in different standards in various sports, a lower net in girls' volleyball, a smaller basketball for girls' teams, a shorter difference from tee to green in girls' golf, and so on. To even qualify to compete against boys in the PIAA Track and Field Championship, a high school female would need to break a female state record in cross-country running. In 2012, 75% of all male athletes finished ahead of the fastest female athlete. Allowing boys to compete with and against girls, the PIAA argued, defeats the purpose of separate classifications, reducing participation opportunities for girls, providing teams using boys with unfair competitive advantages, and enhancing risks of injuries for girls. The general counsel for the PIAA summed the issue up with a series of questions. When equal treatment creates fundamentally unequal and unfair competition, should gender-blind equality trump fairness? Also, if boys and girls can each, and without limitation, play sports designated for the other gender, does there remain any legitimacy in having teams classified by gender? If not, should the classifications be merged and all teams be considered co-ed since gender is not a limitation on which team a student plays? Such an approach would likely devastate female athletics at the high school level and is not a realistic or at least a practical option, he wrote. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that it could not stop the PIAA from enacting a policy that barred boys from playing on girls' teams. But the opinion issued a warning. If the past, as William Shakespeare noted in The Tempest, is truly a prologue, then any such policy may be challenged in a court of law on equal protection grounds. Just a few years later, FloJo's sport got national attention when Natafon Wangyat, a high school senior and biological male who self-identifies as female, was given permission to compete on the girls' track team. He went all the way to Alaska's state competition, placing third and fifth in two events and earning all-state honors, the kind of accolades that appeal to college scholarship officials. Families and students were timidly uncomfortable, with one student telling local news, "I'm glad that this person is comfortable with who they are and they're able to be happy in who they are, but I don't think it's competitively completely 100% fair." A male athlete competing on the boys' team stated the obvious. "I don't know what's politically correct to say, but in my opinion, your gender is what you're born with. It's the DNA. Genetically, a guy has more muscle mass than a girl, and if he's racing against a girl, he may have an advantage." One mom said allowing a biological boy to compete against girls is not fair, and it is not right for our female athletes. We have a responsibility to protect our girls that have worked really hard, that are working towards college scholarships. The Alaska School Activities Association passed the buck. Its board voted unanimously to accept any local school district's decision as to whether to allow members of one sex to compete on the opposite sex's team, and it won't hear any appeals from school districts competing against one another with conflicting policies. In the event that a school or district does not have a policy, the default policy is that a student must compete on teams with his or her own sex. When I spoke with Nina Chaudhry, a Title IX expert at the National Women's Law Center, she affirmed that Title IX was designed to protect women, not men. She told me that despite great gains for girls and women in sports, many are still not getting opportunities to play. In college and high school, only 40% of opportunities to play sports are provided to women. Chaudhry said she is currently working on 12 different Office for Civil Rights complaints from 12 different school districts related to unequal opportunities for girls and boys. She said she's seen girls have to raise money for an ice hockey team when a boys' team already exists with school funding and has heard about unequal facilities, like a spiffy new baseball field for the boys, but a rundown softball field for the girls. So I was stunned when I asked her about biological boys who self-identify as females playing on girls' sports teams, and she brushed it off as nothing to be concerned about. "The differences within the genders can be greater than the differences between the genders," she said, and argued that respect for gender identity is paramount. "If we start drawing lines based on gender stereotypes," she said, "and saying this is okay and this is not, that can lead to harmful discrimination." Just moments before, Chaudhry had affirmed Title IX as a protection for girls, saying that boys are already getting their fair share of athletic opportunities, and allowing a boy onto a girl's team is simply taking a spot from a girl. I was left wondering about the same question the attorney for the PIAA asked. Should the classifications be merged and all teams be considered co-ed, since gender is not a limitation on which team a student plays? It's no longer a rhetorical question. If sex doesn't matter, if we are going to pretend there are no important biological differences between boys and girls, then why have girls' sports at all? Nancy Hogshead Makar, a 3-time Olympic gold medalist in swimming, a sports law professor and Title IX expert, and then senior director of advocacy for the Women's Sports Foundation, has argued that keeping girls' and boys' sports separate is the only way to ensure that girls have the same access to sports participation. In an interview with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, she said, "Sports are unique. Other than bathrooms, they are the only sex-segregated area because of the physical differences between boys and girls." Might we see the downfall of both? Legos for girls. In 2013, the Danish company Lego announced that it had seen a 25% boost in its revenue the year before, with sales nearly triple those of just 5 years before. The reason? Legos for girls. Working in consultation with actual girls, Lego had developed a new product line aimed exclusively at girls called Lego Friends. As one executive put it, "The girls we talked to let us understand that they really wanted a Lego offering that mirrors what the boys experience, but in a way that fulfills their unique desire for redesign and details and combined with realistic themes in community and friendship." The new line of products features scenes of girls doing things like hanging out at City Park Cafe, getting artistic at Emma's Creative Workshop, or visiting Heart Lake Hair Salon. Not every product choice is manifestly girly. The line offers more gender-neutral choices like Heart Lake Airport, Olivia's Exploration Car, and Adventure Camp Archery. But the collection comes in every offensive shade of purple and pink, and heavily features scenes that seem plucked right out of the lives of normal girls today, with an emphasis on creativity and community. It quickly became Lego's 4th best-selling product line. Lego said in a press release that it had been unable to keep up with demand after it was launched. Lego even came out with a giant Disney castle set, which writer Jonathan Last called a Lego Death Star for girls, a big 4,080-piece step toward gender equality, and the kind of set that would make a girl scream uncontrollably on Christmas morning. "What Lego finally seems to understand," Last wrote, "is that however much some people might wish it otherwise, more often than not, boys and girls have different tastes in toys." Even the White House struggles with this reality. In April of 2016, it hosted a major summit on gender stereotypes in toys. But do kids actually have gender preferences in toys? A recent study on toy preferences in babies as young as 9 months found the answer to be a clear yes. Researchers at the City University of London gave babies a choice of gender-specific toys like a cooking pot, doll, ball, and truck, and studied what each sex gravitated toward and how long they played with the toy.